Could we start if everyone is more or less settled? I'm very pleased to introduce Professor Jean-Jean Rocher this evening. Professor Rocher is currently visiting LSE as BP Centennial Professor. In his day job, so to speak, he is Professor of Mathematics and Economics at the University of Toulouse in France, but he's actually here for the whole year, and we're very pleased to have him as a member of the LSE community for the year. He's written a great deal in the areas of banking supervision and financial regulation, the core backdrop to his lecture tonight. The BP Centennial Professorship Scheme was established in 1990 and has made a very major intellectual contribution to the life of the school, and I'd like to thank BP for the continuing support of this program, which makes it possible to increase the already diverse intellectual nature of the LSE community. Professor Rocher's title tonight is there before you. Why are there so many banking crises? I asked him on the way in the answer to the question, but he said wait and see. So now we'll get the answer. Please give him a very nice warm welcome.
Thank you very much. Mr. Director, ladies and gentlemen, it is a great privilege for me to give this BP lecture in front of you today. And to tell you the truth, I am very impressed. For one thing, I'm very impressed that Director Giddens himself has accepted to chair this lecture. I'm a big admirer of your academic work and also of the influence of this work and policy decisions, not only here in the UK, but also in other countries. In fact, I wish the former French Prime Minister, Lionel Jospin, had read The Third Way, a book that I would like to call, if you allow me the expression, Giddens' Bible. Indeed, if Jospin had read this book more carefully, we could have avoided the disaster of the last French presidential election. The second reason why I'm very impressed today is that I find myself in a very awkward position. Indeed, I'm going to lecture in English, with a terrible French accent, on the topic of banking crisis in the London School of Economics. And as you all know, the LSE is certainly the academic center with the highest concentration in the world of top specialists of money and banking. If you add up the Department of Accounting and Finance, the Financial Market Group, and the Department of Economics, to understand my present feelings, picture yourself in a similar situation where you would have to lecture in French on the topic of French cuisine in the Paris restaurant La Tour d'Argent in the presence of the best French chefs. So this is how I feel today. Of course, you could rightly argue that I was not obliged to accept this offer. As a matter of fact, when Sudipta Bhattacharya and Peter Miller approached me 2 years ago to inquire whether I would be interested in holding the BP Centennial Visiting Professorship in the Department of Accounting and Finance in the LSE, I was delighted. And when David Webb offered me on top of that to benefit from an office in the Financial Market Group, I was positively thrilled and I immediately said yes. My decision to accept this offer was, of course, influenced by the prestige of this position, but also by the fact that I'd started working on the topic of the today, namely banking crisis. And as I told you before, the LSE is the place in the world to work on this topic. So if the views that I will defend today in front of you are largely based on my previous work with several of my co-authors, like Jean Tirole from Toulouse and MIT, Xavier Freixas from Barcelona, Bruno Parigi from Padova, and Xavier Vives from INSEAD, these views were also deeply influenced by discussion this year with several LSE professors. Let us come now to the substance. Namely, why are there so many banking crises? Indeed, the last 20 years have seen an impressive number of banking and financial crises all over the world. In an interesting study of the IMF, Caprio and Klingebeil identify 112 systemic banking crises in 93 countries and 51 borderline crises in 46 countries since the late 70s. More than 130 out of 180 of the IMF countries have thus experienced crises or serious banking problems. Similarly, the cost of the savings and loans crisis in the USA in the late 80s has been estimated to over $150 billion, which is more than the cumulative loss of all failed US banks during the Great Depression, even after adjusting for inflation. On average, the fiscal cost of each of these recent banking crises was of the order of 12% of the country's GDP, but exceeded 40% in some of the most recent episodes in Argentina, Indonesia, Korea, and Malaysia. Here is a map that I like. The countries represented in blue are the ones that have experienced banking crises, while the countries in red have only experienced significant banking problems. And as for the countries in white, either we don't have sufficient information, like probably for most Arabic countries, or these countries have not experienced any significant banking problem. I do not know how Namibia has succeeded to avoid the problems of all neighboring countries, but I know for a fact that Greenland authorities have avoided the crisis because they have been able to freeze the bank's asset before it was too late. More seriously, these crises have renewed the interest of economic research on several questions: the causes of fragility of banks and the possible ways to remedy this fragility, the justifications and organization of public intervention, which takes several forms: liquidity assistance by central banks, lender of last resort, various regulation, notably solvency requirements, supervisory systems, which are supposed to monitor the activities of banks and can decide to close them. Finally, in many countries, depositors are now covered by deposit insurance schemes in case their bank fails. Important reforms have been introduced in the supervisory systems. For example, the American Congress has enacted the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Improvement Act in 1991, after the savings and loans crisis. Several countries, notably the UK, have created integrated supervisory authorities for all financial services, including banking, insurance, and securities dealing. Finally, the G10 countries have harmonized in 1988 their solvency regulations for international active banks. This harmonization, known as the Basel Accord, since it was designed by the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision, was later adopted at national levels by a great number of countries. And the Basel Committee is currently working on a revision of this accord, aiming in particular at giving more importance to market discipline. Well, the objective of this lecture is to build on recent research in order to understand better the causes of banking crises and possibly offer policy guidelines for reform of regulatory supervisory systems. In a nutshell, our main conclusion today will be that banking crises are largely amplified, if not provoked, by political interference. Supervision systems face a fundamental commitment problem. And finally, the key to successful reform is independence and accountability of banking supervisors. So the plan of the lecture would be the following. I will start by the historical sources of banking fragility. Then I will examine the first remedy, the lender of last resort. A second remedy, deposit insurance and solvency regulation. And I will try to draw a few lessons from recent crises. And finally, I would like to conclude by examining the future of banking supervision. So, first of all, the source of banking fragility. Historically, banks started as money changers. This is testified by etymology. If I'm not mistaken, trapeza, the Greek word for a bank, refers to the trapezoidal balance that was used by money changers to weigh the precious coins. Similarly, banco or banca, the Italian word for a bank, refers to the bench used by money changers to display their currencies. Interestingly, this money changing activity naturally led early bankers to provide also deposit facilities to merchants using the vaults and safes already in place for storing their precious coins. In England, the same movement was initiated by Goldsmith. Similarly, some merchants exploited their networks of trade posts to offer payment services to other merchants. By transferring bills of exchange from one post to the other instead of carrying specie and gold along the roads. In both cases, early bankers realized very soon that the specie and gold deposited in their vaults could be profitably reinvested in other commercial and industrial activities. This was the beginning of the fractional reserve system, in which a fraction of demandable deposits are used to finance long-term illiquid loans. This is represented by this simplified balance sheet of a representative bank. So as long as the bank keeps enough reserves to cover the withdrawals of the depositor who actually need their money, which is less than the total amount of deposits, the system can function smoothly and efficiently. But the system is intrinsically fragile. If all depositors demand their money simultaneously, they are entitled to, the situation is referred to as a bank run. The bank is forced to liquidate its assets at short notice, which may provoke its failure. A spectacular example of a bank run occurred in October 1995 in Japan, where the Hyogo Bank experienced more than $1 billion withdrawals in one day. Closures are necessary in order to eliminate inefficient institutions. Such runs correspond to what is known as fundamental run, where depositors withdraw their money because the bank's assets are revealed to be bad investments. This Darwinian mechanism is useful to eliminate unsuccessful banks and incent bankers to select carefully their investments. But unfortunately, bank runs can also happen for purely speculative reasons. A recent example of a speculative run occurred in 1991 in Rhode Island in the US, where a perfectly solvent bank was forced to close after the TV channel CNN used a picture of his bank to illustrate a story on bank closures. As we will see, small depositors are now insured in many countries, which means that the modern form of a bank run is more what is called a silent run, where professional investors stop renewing their large deposits, or certificate of deposits, as they are called, which is the case, for example, in the Continental Illinois failure in 1984. The mechanism of a speculative run is simple. If each depositor anticipates that other depositors are going to withdraw in mass, then it is in their interest to join the movement, even if they know for sure that the bank's assets are fundamentally safe. Given that these speculative runs are seriously damaging to the banking sector, several mechanisms have been elaborated to eliminate those speculative runs. The first example was the institution of a lender of last resort. The lender of last resort, which consists of emergency liquidity assistance provided by the central banks to the bank in trouble, was invented, so to speak, in this country, and the doctrine was articulated in 1873 by the English economist Walter Bagehot, elaborating on previous ideas of Henry Thornton, governor of the Bank of England at the end of the 18th century. Bagehot's doctrine was influenced by the systemic crisis that followed the failure of Overend Gurney and Company in May 1866. Overend and Gurney was at the time the greatest discounting house, that is the broker of bills of exchange, if you like, in the world. During the previous financial crisis of 1825, it was able to make short loans, i.e. provide liquidity assistance to most of the banks on the London place. And it became known as the banker's banker. After the death of its founder, Samuel Gurney, in 1856, the company was placed under less competent control. Experiencing big losses on some of its loans, it was forced to declare bankruptcy in May 1866 with more than £11 million in liabilities. As a result of this failure, many small banks lost their only provider of liquidity and were forced to fail as well, even though they were intrinsically solvent. In order to avoid such crises, Bagehot recommended that the Bank of England be ready to provide liquidity assistance to individual banks in distress. The main points of Bagehot's doctrine were that the central bank should A, lend only against good collateral, so that only solvent banks might borrow, and that the central bank would be protected against losses. B, lend at a quote-unquote very high interest rate, so that only quote-unquote illiquid banks might borrow, and that ordinary liquidity provision would be performed by the market and not by the central bank. And C, announce in advance its readiness to lend without limits in order to establish its credibility to nip the contagion process in the bud. The doctrine was first put into applications by the Bank of England in the Bering crisis of 1890. It was then adopted on the continent, resulting in the absence of a major banking crisis for more than 30 years. In the USA, prior to the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913, commercial banks organized a clearinghouse system which served as a private lender of last resort for several decades. Among more recent examples where Bagehot's doctrine was followed to the letter are the Bank of New York case of 1985 and the second Bearings crisis in 1985. On November 21, 1985, the Bank of New York experienced a computer bug. It was a leading participant in the US Treasury bond market, and the computer had paid out good funds for the bonds bought by the bank, but would not accept cash in payments for the bonds sold. So this quickly led to a $22.6 billion deficit. Even if there was no doubt about the solvency of the Bank of New York, no single bank was in a position to cover such a huge deficit by an emergency loan. Similarly, there was not enough time to organize a consortium of lenders. So the New York Fed solved the problem by providing an emergency loan against good collateral. On February 24, 1995, Barings, once again, made it known to the Bank of England that its securities subsidiary in Singapore had lost $1.4 billion, three times the capital of the bank, due to the fraudulent operation of one of its traders. The Bank of England decided that since bilateral exposure were relatively limited and the source of Bering's failure was a specific case of fraud, the threat of contagion in the UK financial system was not large enough to justify the commitment of public funds. As a result, the bank failed on February 26. However, the Bank of England clearly made public its willingness to provide adequate liquidity to the UK banking system in case of a market disturbance. And as a matter of fact, the announcement itself was enough to avoid any such disturbance. It is interesting to notice that in these two episodes, the intervention of the Bank of England was triggered by different types of situations. It was a failure of the market to provide liquidity assistance to a solvent bank, in the case of the Bank of New York. And it was a desire to provide liquidity support to the market, and more specifically to the bank, that might have been affected by the closure of a major participant in the Bearings case. However, in both cases, Bagehot's doctrine was followed in that taxpayers' money was not involved. This is unfortunately not always the case. There are indeed several reasons why the central bank might consider supporting insolvent institutions. The first is systemic risk, i.e., the fear that the failure of a large institution might propagate to the rest of the financial system. Given that the central bank is typically responsible for the overall stability of the financial system, it is conceivable that it considers assisting large institutions whose failure might propagate to other banks. This was a rationale involved in several occasions, for example, in the bailout of Johnson Matthey Bankers by the Bank of England. Even if the bank waited for more than a year before organizing a consortium. And a similar case is that of Continental Illinois in the USA, both in 1984 and the bailout of the Continental Authority of Illinois led to the unfortunate notion of a bank that would be too big to fail. A second reason why insolvent banks might be bailed out is political interference. Let me take as an illustration the case of my own country, unfortunately, France, where it is interesting to contrast two episodes. The first episode, although I should say the first case, corresponds to the failure in 1988 and 1989 of two Franco-Arab banks, Al Saudi Bank and Kuwait French Bank, who were essentially recycling petrodollars in loans to developing countries. And they experienced important losses on their lending portfolios. The Bank of France decided not to intervene, and the two banks were forced to close. By contrast, the largest French bank of the time, Le Crédit Lyonnais, whose slogan was ironically the power to say yes, started in 1988 a disastrous policy of bad investments, which initially resulted only in a spectacular increase of its activity, of its total balance sheet of 30% in 2 years, and a 200% increase of its industrial holdings. However, very soon, heavy losses materialized, 0.3 billion dollars in 92, 1.2 billion in 1993, and 2 billion in 1994. After some time, the French government felt compelled to intervene. The total cost of the three successive rescue plans that were implemented was estimated to $25 billion, which in per capita terms is of the same order of magnitude as the total cost of the saving and loan crisis in the US, only that we the French were able to do that with one bank only, and it was enough to dilapidate the equivalent of £700 per French taxpayer. A similar situation occurred in Japan during the Jusen crisis, 1995-1999. Jusen were non-deposit-taking subsidiaries of banks created to provide affordable home financing for individual borrowers. The frenetic lending activity of this institution contributed to the building up of the Japanese real estate bubble, and when this bubble burst in 1995, the Japanese authorities had to inject the equivalent of $24 billion in order to avoid the collapse of the Japanese financial system. Japanese banks are also famous for several spectacular episodes of fraud. For example, in 1990, it was disclosed by Daiwa Bank that a security trader in his New York branch had been able to conceal a cumulative loss of $1.1 billion on U.S. securities over 11 years. Similarly, in 1996, Sumitomo acknowledged that one of his copper traders was responsible for fraudulent transactions that amounted to a cumulative loss of $1.8 billion over 10 years. So it's, roughly speaking, enough to provide a decent income to 10,000 people for 10 years. A single person was responsible for that. So let me now turn to two other fundamental mechanisms of public intervention in the banking sector, namely deposit insurance and solvency regulations. In the USA, the first deposit insurance fund was created in 1934 when the FDIC was set up in order to prevent bank runs and to protect small and unsophisticated depositors. The initial coverage was $2,500, but it was gradually increased to the present figures of $100,000. In the UK, the system is less generous since coverage is only limited to 75% of the first £20,000. In continental Europe, deposit insurance has long been implicit in the sense that losses were often covered ex post by taxpayers' money or by a compulsory contribution of surviving banks, what the Bank of France calls solidarité de place. A European Union directive of 1994 requires a minimum harmonization among member countries. Implementation of explicit deposit insurance systems with a minimum coverage of €20,000 funded by risk-based insurance premiums. It has been argued that these deposit insurance systems were partly responsible, paradoxically, for the fragility of the banking system, whereas in fact they were imagined or designed exactly for the opposite. So why is that so? Well, several studies of the IMF tend to show but I will discuss this evidence later, that countries that have implemented such systems are more likely to experience banking crises, surprisingly. The proposed explanation is that in such countries, bankers feel free to take excessive risks, given that their insured depositors are not concerned by the possibility of a failure of the banks, and they are insured in all cases. In the absence of a deposit insurance system, like is the case in New Zealand, for example, bankers are disciplined by the threat of massive withdrawals when depositors become aware of any excessive risk-taking by their bank. The doctrine in New Zealand since December 1994 is thus, quote-unquote, freedom with publicity. Banks are not really supervised, but are only required to disclose detailed information on their accounts to their customers, and bank directors are personally liable in case of false disclosure statements. As I will argue later, I'm not convinced by this solution. In most other countries, the reaction to banking crisis has been, on the contrary, to reinforce banking regulation, and in particular solvency regulations. This started at the international level, where the Basel Committee of Banking Supervision enacted in 1988 a regulation requiring a minimum capital level of 8% of risk-weighted assets for international active banks of the G10 countries. The different weights were supposed to reflect the credit risk of the corresponding assets, and this regulation was later amended to incorporate interest rate risk and market risk. It was also implemented with small variations at the domestic level by the banking authorities of several countries. And in particular, in the context of the USA, the reform of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation system introduced an important notion, that of prompt corrective action, which is some form of gradualism in the intervention of supervisors, in order to force them to intervene before it's too late. And this is based on a full set of indicators known as Camel's ratings. Let me now discuss the justifications for this solvency regulation, and they are essentially twofold. First, provide a minimum buffer against losses on banks' assets so as to decrease their probability of failure. The second justification is to provide incentives to bank stockholders to monitor the bank manager more closely because they have more to lose in case of failure. However, the Basel Accord of 1988 was severely criticized for being too crude and encouraging regulatory arbitrage by commercial banks. It was argued in particular that it was responsible for a credit crunch in the early 1990s because banks find it profitable to substitute government securities to commercial and industrial loans. Now let me try to draw some lessons from the recent crisis. The crisis of the last 25 years have provided very useful evidence for research. Economists have examined several questions. For example, Ogoth, a recent supporter of the Bank of England, criticized the use of fiscal cost, that is, the amount transferred from taxpayer to creditors of failed banks, as a true measure of the economic cost of banking crises. Indeed, those fiscal costs are more a transfer than an aggregate cost to society. So what they propose instead, with other people, is to evaluate the output loss, i.e. the amount of wealth that would have been provided or produced in the country in the absence of a crisis. They find that this estimated output loss is large, around 15 to 20% of the annual GDP, and is even larger in the case of a twin crisis, that is to say, a currency crisis occurring simultaneously with a banking crisis. This confirms previous studies of Kaminsky and Reinhardt, and a different pattern seems to emerge in developed countries and developing countries. In developed countries, banking crises alone are already very costly, whereas in developing countries, it seems that the cost is significant only in the case of a twin crisis. So I will not deal with this aspect today, since I'm focusing on the case of developed countries, and I don't want to attack the question of currency crises. But other economists, like Bell and Payne or Phil Davis, have tried to establish common patterns of banking crises and derive indicators for predicting those crises. For example, Davis argues in particular that the East Asian crisis that started in 1997 exhibited features very similar to earlier crises in Scandinavia or Japan, namely vulnerability to real shocks, such as export prices variations, and foreign currency exposure. However, the East Asian crisis had a very little impact on securities market of the OECD countries, by contrast with the Russian crisis of August 1998. The reason seems to be that the moratorium on Russian public debt generated an unwinding of leverage positions on US Treasury markets, $80 billion for LTCM alone, more than $3,000 billion for commercial banks altogether. Whereas the Asian crisis only resulted in bank runs instead of affecting markets, and so the consequence was only failure of domestic banks. Also, economists have tried to assess the characteristics of banking systems that were more likely to be associated with a large probability of crisis or a large cost of resolution. Onohan and Klingebiel show in particular that pre-crisis provision of liquidity support, which is often used by governments to delay the recognition of a crisis, is the most significant predictor of a high fiscal cost once the crisis erupts. Finally, the Scandinavian banking crisis of 1991-1992 was much more dramatic in Finland and to a lesser extent in Norway than in Sweden and Denmark. The common causes were deregulation, somewhat improvised deregulation of financial markets, an economic boom and an asset market bubble, followed by a real shock, which in the case of Finland was essentially the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the result of that was a massive devaluation, an asset bubble burst, and as a result, one large commercial banks and the entire saving bank sector had to be taken over by the government. Non-performing assets were separated and transferred to a bad bank, and public support to all of the banks was provided, but the stockholders of the bank were not fully expropriated, and some managers remain in charge. As a result, the cost was huge, 17.2% of GDP. If you compare with Norway, it's even more compelling in the case of Denmark and Sweden, the causes were the same as in Finland, except that the real shock was more an oil price decrease than the collapse of the Soviet Union, as for Finland. But the symptoms were similar. Three large commercial banks and two regional saving banks had to be bailed out by public funds because they incurred large losses on the loan portfolio and were, as a result, were undercapitalized. But the government was tougher. It injected money only in exchange for drastic reduction in loan portfolio and important cost cuts. And shareholders were fully expropriated, which is not the case in Finland. Of course, the shareholders later required compensation because the banks actually continued, but they lost the case. And bank managers and directors were almost systematically replaced. And as a result of that, the cost was much smaller, less than 3% of GDP. So let me try now to conclude by trying to assess the possible future of banking supervision. Let me be a little bit more polemic by starting by the remark that the traditional approach to banking supervision was very paternalistic. Banks were protected from competition through entry restrictions, price controls, in exchange for accepting to follow the detailed prescription of supervisors. This approach is not viable anymore for several reasons. First of all, globalization and deregulation have made competition very fierce, in particular by non-banks, which are non-regulated. Also, the increased complexity of financial markets and banking activities implies that supervisors are not anymore in a position to monitor closely the activities of all banks. This feature is illustrated by the failure of the Basel Committee to impose a standardized approach to market risks. Instead, the committee was obliged to accept that large banks use their own internal models. It is expected that in the near future, very few banks will follow the standardized approach, and they will probably prefer to use one of the models developed by the large banks. The proposed reform of the Basel Accord is supposed to rely on three quote-unquote pillars: a refined capital requirement with very complex weights, these complex weights are designed to be more in line with market assessments of risk, a more proactive role of banking supervisors, and an increased recourse to market discipline. The problem is that supervisors have a general tendency to interfere too much when the banks are well run, and intervene too less when the banks have problems. Too much attention, in my opinion, has been devoted to the first pillar, namely the design of a very complicated system of risk weights. In my opinion, it is not the job of the regulators to tell the banks what they have to do when they are not in trouble. On the contrary, their job is to take care of ailing banks. Thus, I believe more attention should be devoted to the two other pillars of Basel II, namely supervision and market discipline. In particular, and I'm sorry that you cannot read the full slide, in particular, it should be stated precisely when and how supervisors will intervene and which instrument should be used to generate market discipline. Several US economists, for example, have proposed compulsory subordinated debt. So without going into the detail, let me just mention that subordinated debt is a good instrument for generating market discipline. It can be a direct market discipline, since the cost of issuing new debt increases when the risk profile of the bank increases. So thus, if the bank is forced to issue subordinated debt on a regular basis, it will have incentives not to take too much risk. And there is also indirect market discipline, because the price of subordinated debt on secondary markets decreases when the risk of failure of the bank increases. So the secondary market price of subordinated debt provides additional information to the regulator on the perceived risk of failure of the bank. But the real concern is supervision, not regulation. One needs to be sure that supervisors impose corrective measures or even close the bank before it is too late. The core of the problem is that the bank is always worth more alive than dead. This is because the informational capital of the bank is lost in case of closure. So even a competent and benevolent planner would always find preferable ex post to provide liquidity assistance to a bank in distress. But of course, if this is anticipated by bankers, this can be the source of moral hazard. Proper incentives can only be provided if stockholders and top managers are truly expropriated in case of problems, like the Norwegian case is a good illustration. Empirical evidence on the resolution of bank default suggests that failing banks are more often rescued than liquidated. For example, Goodhart and Schoenmaker in 1995 show that the effective methods of resolving banking problems vary a lot from country to country, but in most cases, they result in bailouts. Out of a sample of 104 failing banks, Goodhart and Schoenmaker find that 73 resulted in rescue and only 31 in actual liquidation. This is confirmed by other studies. For example, Santomero and Hoffman in 1998 show that in the USA, the discount window, that is the lender of last resort facility, was often used improperly to rescue banks that subsequently failed. So market discipline can be useful in two respects: by directly penalizing the banks who take too much risk without the need for an intervention by supervisors, indirectly providing new objective information like private ratings, yield spreads, or secondary prices of debt that can be used by supervisors. But market discipline is dangerous. In particular, during crises, market prices become erratic and diverge from fundamentals. Coordination failures may occur between investors, whereby each of them has a good and justified opinion of the solvency of a given bank, but refuses to buy its subordinated debt because he anticipates that other investor will not lend to it. This is what game theoretician called self-fulfilling prophecies. The theoretical analysis of this was done by Maurice and Sheen for currency crises, and later Vives and myself, we developed an extension for banking crises. But there are other dangers of market discipline. For example, it is proposed by the reform of the Basel Accord to condition capital requirements on market ratings, private ratings. But can we really trust rating agencies? They often have less information than the supervisors, and sometimes even less than other banks. Secondly, the market for rating is not really competitive, and conflict of interest between auditing and consulting activities may occur, as was exemplified by the recent Enron Anderson case. Finally, market discipline can be a vehicle for contagion. It could be a good disciplining device during good times, in particular subordinated debt, but it can also be a vehicle for systemic risk during crisis. And a theoretical analysis of this was done by Tirole and myself in 1996. The main difficulty, I believe, is to obtain credibility of regulation and to get rid of political pressure on banking supervisors. So the source of this difficulty is not only corruption and regulatory capture, but more fundamentally, the absence of commitment power of governments. It's a classical time consistency problem. It's even more severe in the case of democracies than in the case of corrupt regimes. We argue in favor of independence and accountability of banking supervisors, like has been done for monetary policy. So instead of discretionary power given to bank supervisors, the sometimes referred to as constructive ambiguity proposal, we advocate in favor of an explicit mandate given to banking supervisory agencies, which is, of course, difficult to design, and that's a task for further research. For example, it would be useful to define objective criteria for deciding when a bank has to be bailed out for systemic reasons, and also an ex post control or accountability with sanctions on supervisors if they don't perform well. To conclude, I believe the main reason behind the frequency and magnitude of recent banking crises is not deposit insurance, is not bad regulation, is not incompetence of supervisors. It is more likely the commitment problem of political authorities who are likely to exert pressure for bailing out insolvent banks. The remedy to political pressure on bank supervisor is not to substitute supervision by market discipline, because market discipline can only be effective if absence of government intervention is anticipated. So the crucial problem is credibility of political authorities. So instead, the way to restore this credibility is to ensure independence and accountability of bank supervisors. Mr. Director, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention.
We've now got a certain amount of time for questions. There should be roving mics. There are roving mics. Please, anyone who wants to ask a question, do so, and ask you to speak up when you so do. Please.
May I ask,
do you want to take the microphone, because people upstairs can hear?
May I ask you, sir, very broadly, do you anticipate more banking crises in the near future in view of the extraordinary activities within the last year or and a half, and particularly in view of the Argentine crisis?
Well, it's a very difficult question, and as somebody said, the forecasting is very difficult, especially when it concerns the future. I must say that in the past we have observed cycles. For example, in the 25 years after the Second World War, there were virtually no banking crises at all. And then in the last quarter of the 20th century, there was a huge number of banking crises. So by a simple extrapolation, let me anticipate that in the next 25 years, we won't see any crises, but they will come back later.
These are in the middle there.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if you could please comment on your views on the consolidation of financial institutions creating behemoths such as Citigroup and the desire for other global corporations to mimic that model. yes, it raises new challenges in regulation. Do you feel that there is a sort of safety in the kind of capital that an institution of that size can bring?
Well, first of all, I believe it's extremely difficult to resist against market forces, provided that true competition is preserved. And so I believe it would be extremely difficult to impose barriers to such consolidations. But I believe that more attention needs to be focused on those large and complex banking organizations, as the Americans call them. And I really believe that we should have a specific treatment for those large and somewhat opaque organizations. And in particular, in the view of the gradual interventionism of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Improvement Act in the US, that is the prompt corrective action, which defines several levels of intervention, it is my view that the early stage of intervention should be more strict in the case of large organizations or conglomerates, financial conglomerates, because they are more opaque to some extent. But on the other hand, I have I'm of the view that once you get a better picture of what's going on, you cannot neglect the natural diversification advantages of such large corporations. So I believe that if you know more or less what those large organizations are doing, you should not be particularly worried. The main worry is about opaqueness. And of course, there is also this issue of too big to fail, because if we have a huge international conglomerates in Europe, it will probably create an immense disruption if it has problems. So I believe that we have to be careful about this other form of moral hazard that could be generated by this large institution. But I really believe that opaqueness is one of the major concerns about those large organizations.
Do you have a question from upstairs?
Thank you. I'd just like to ask you how you imagine we can, because you want to replace constructive ambiguity, and my understanding is the purpose of constructive ambiguity is you avoid or you try and diminish the risks of moral hazard mm-hmm. by making it unclear when people can expect to be rescued. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to make an explicit contract mm-hmm. for supervisors, and particularly you emphasized that you wanted to make it much clearer when a systematic risk mm-hmm. Problem might entail a bank bailout, how are you going to prevent institutions from knowing when they're too big to fail and acting accordingly?
No, it's a well-taken point. I understand the argument that constructing ambiguity may be an instrument for fighting against moral hazard, but I believe that the cost is bigger in the sense that you cannot have accountability with an ambiguous system. So I believe that this argument is more than offset. The argument that it could be useful for fighting moral hazard is more than offset of the cost, which is the lack of accountability of the system. And I think that moral hazard can also be fought by other means, like gradualism, like prompt corrective action. That is, if you have a big institution, which is presumably too big to fail, then you want to intervene much before because you are worried that things might go wrong very fast. So I believe that the correct answer is prompt corrective action.
Hello. Are you surprised at the absence of a banking crisis in the given the disruption following September the 11th and the deterioration in that we've seen a number of large corporate credits, things like Enron, Kmart, mm-hmm. Marconi, etc.?
Mm-hmm. No, it's true that we could have imagined worse situations. And in particular, I was more worried of the reinsurance sector rather than the banking sector. Because, as you know, the insurance business is organized in a different fashion in the sense that you have a hierarchical system where direct insurers are insured by reinsurers, and only direct insurers are subject to solvency regulation supervision. So I believe it's even more worrying in the context of the insurance industry that you have these huge reinsurers that are virtually under the control of no single institution. And it is true that event like September 11 could have triggered the failure of a big reinsurer, and we would have been in real trouble, I believe. So I was really surprised to see that apparently only small reinsurers failed, and no more damage to the insurance industry.
I have a question from, is there any questions? Oh, maybe up the back there. I'm trying to get someone on the left-hand side of the room.
I think your answer begs another question, namely, why has the commitment problem of governments become worse in recent years, if your analysis is correct, that a banking crisis have become more frequent and worse in the last years? Mm. At least in the EU, it should have become less, because the EU, the Commission, can punish you for illegal government subsidies.
Mm. Well, it is true that the outside conditions have changed, in particular the deregulation, globalization have changed the nature of risks, and also the status quo that was prevailing before, namely protection from competition by a banking authority in exchange for compliance to the desire of the supervisors. This has broken into pieces. And the lack of commitment of political powers is not the only explanation, of course, to the banking crisis. But my view is that it has probably amplified the magnitude of those crises, and that they would have probably occurred in any case, but could have been limited immediately, repetition of crises in certain countries could have been avoided. So I'm not saying it's a unique explanation for banking crisis. I'm trying to be a little more polemic, because what you hear usually is deregulation, safety net, I mean deposit insurance and all kinds of things. I believe these are partial explanations, but the true explanation, which is not emphasized, is really this lack of commitment power. I want to insist on the fact that even in a democratic country functioning very well with no corruptions, no lobbying or interest groups, the problem arises. So it's, I believe, a genuine difficulty.
Hold the back there.
You talk a little bit about making banking supervisors becoming independent and accountable. Given the increasingly global nature of financial markets, I mean, who would you envisage them being accountable to? Who would you see actually policing that they were hitting the objectives?
I'm sorry, I did not get you. Could you speak louder?
You talk about banking supervisors being independent and accountable, but given the increasingly global nature of financial markets, mm-hmm. who would you see they being accountable to? Who would be policing their adherence to the objectives being set?
Well, I believe to the legislative authorities, and I've not actually thought in detail about the question, given that I'm not a specialist of law. But I don't think the additional complexity of industry of markets and banking activities, it seems to me that it tends to limit the role of banking supervisors, and that market discipline has to be an important complement to that. But I don't see why it would modify the type of accountability or reward and penalty system that have to be designed for supervisors. I don't really see why the complexification changes the difficulty of the problem. It changes the nature of the mandate and the agenda, which has to be set in sufficiently simple terms that it can be checked ex post. but it doesn't change the, I believe, the type of reward and penalty mechanism that has to be implemented.
So another question from upstairs at all? In which case, there is, good.
Just wanted to ask you one question. The banks today have become multinational, whereas the supervisory boards are all pretty much national or region levels. Do you see this as an inherent problem in future?
No, not necessarily. Let me take the example of Europe, of the European Union, where supervision is at the national level. Which this has been criticized, in particular for the possibility of the system to react promptly in case of a major crisis. But I believe there is some positive aspect to it, namely the possibility of competition between supervisors, because constituencies are able to benchmark the performance of their supervisors as opposed to that of other regions. So I believe that there is some positive aspect in it.
One last question from anybody?
To what do you attribute, Professor?
Can you just speak up a bit?
To what do you attribute, Professor, the fact that the UK is virtually one of the only major world economies that has not suffered a banking crisis?
Well, it is true that on the map that I showed, UK was in white, but on the other hand, I gave several examples of minor crises, let's say, which show that the UK was not totally protected from those. And I believe that my talk has exemplified the leading role, in some extent, of this country in the design of central banking organizations and supervision. So I believe that in some cases the UK has been the first to experiment new regulations or new systems with somewhat a certain success, but also in some cases some relative failures. But I really believe, and I think the topic was in some sense appropriate, because most of the examples I've gave were taken from the Bank of England and the English economists.
Let me just say what a pleasure it is to have Professor Rocher here this year, and ask you to thank him for his thoroughly absorbing lecture. Thanks very much.